Hello everybody, welcome to number 27. I'm Jack, and today I'm going to introduce you to one of my absolute heroes, the Citroën SM. Now, Citroën bought a whole car company just to make this car a reality. It was more advanced than anything else out at the time. And yet, two disastrous events meant that eventually it made Citroën bankrupt. It all started with the Citroën DS, which was a really, really successful car. Again, very, very advanced. But when Citroën made the DS, there was some compromises that they had to undertake. It was originally designed to run a six-cylinder engine. But as they were designing it, they ran out of cash and they were forced to use some of their older, quite humdrum, four-cylinder engines. So it never reached its full potential. In 1961, Citroën started Project S. The idea was to try and combine some of the technology from the DS with a worthy engine. However, by 1968, they still weren't very far ahead in terms of the engine. They saw that Maserati was struggling and was looking for a new owner, and they decided to buy the company literally just so they could get a suitable engine for their new project. The end result is this, the SM. Let's take it out for a drive, and I'm going to tell you how it was so advanced, why it still failed, and how it stacks up and how it drives on the road today. Finding it slightly difficult to moderate the throttle, that's the first thing that comes to mind, but only when you're pulling away. Afterwards, it seems to work fine. The other thing is that the steering at these low speeds is very strange. Now, the thing is, it's a fully powered setup. So even at a standstill, if you turn the wheel and then let go, it will completely self-center on its own, which takes some getting used to, really. The gear change is the same as was in my Lotus, my Turbo Esprit from 1984. People complain about them in the Esprits, but I absolutely love it. And in this car, it's actually a bit lighter for some reason. It must be something to do with the linkage. So why was it so advanced? Well, the list is almost endless. As I've mentioned, it has that fully powered steering, which is also really fast. It's two turns lock to lock. Because it's fully powered, they're able to run zero caster. That means that when you turn the wheels, the camber doesn't change, so that equals more grip and less torque steer. It was front-wheel drive, which for the time was very, very unusual and didn't have the negative connotations that it sometimes still has today. It has lights that point in the direction in which you're turning the car. They came as an option with what are called the plastic wheels. Those were carbon-reinforced resin wheels. They were developed because this was going to be raced, I think, in the Paris-Dakar, and they wanted some lighter wheels. The owner of this car actually has those, but runs the steels normally, which I would agree with because I think the steels look better. Another absolutely astounding fact is that the aerodynamics were unbelievable. 0.26 is the CD. Nowadays, a Tesla Model 3, which is a very aerodynamic car, 50 years later after this was sold, 0.23, so just 0.3 better than this car. The aerodynamics are truly astounding. It also just looked like absolutely nothing else. It's not pretty from every angle, I have to be honest. From some angles, it looks a little bit, I don't know, it looks a little bit uncomfortable, it looks a little bit fussy, but then you see it from another angle and it works so well. It's one of those cars that, you know, I think we can debate about who makes the best cars or which nation made the best sort of cars in the world, and I'm going to do a video about that. But when it comes to which nation made the most interesting cars, I think that there is absolutely not a shadow of a doubt that it was the French. I mean, from the DS to this to some of their later cars, I mean, I guess it's mainly Citroën, but Renault have done some really interesting out there stuff as well. So, The interior as well is so spaceship. When this came out in the early 70s, can you imagine what people must have thought of it?
There's some lovely little touches like that interior door release, the chrome surround for the gear shift, and of course those awesome oval clocks.
So when it first came out, this car was $12,000. In terms today, it's about £10,000, but I don't think it's comparable because the currencies will have appreciated at different rates. Anyway, $12,000 at the time bought a Mercedes SLC. It bought a 911 or an E-Type. This was much more advanced than all those cars, but well, definitely even more than the SLC, which was quite a modern design in the early 70s. In the first 2 years, it sold really quite well. In 71 and 72, they sold, I think, 4,000 one year, 5,000 units in another. So it started off pretty well, but then two disastrous things happened, which changed absolutely everything for this car. That was 1973, the oil crisis, which meant that selling a car which used a lot of petrol like this with a big engine was an absolute no-no. But perhaps worse is that it started to be associated with some real reliability issues. There are various problems there, but the first is that Maserati, when it was taken on to do this job, Citroën only gave them 6 months to produce a six-cylinder. Now, their existing engines were V8s. The only way they could design and make a new engine that quickly was to lob off two cylinders from the V8. V8s run well with a 90-degree angle. That's their best sort of primary balance. V6, though, is around 60 degrees. So the engine that was made had one failing, and that is at idle, and we can see it with this car. It's actually a bit lumpy, it's a bit rough. It does not feel like a luxury V6 engine should. On top of that though, there were these reliability issues. So the timing chain was weak, and I think that's also because of all the ancillaries that were being run off the engine. Maserati apparently weren't warned about that. And all the ancillaries put extra stress on the crank. When they came in, things like the aircon, it would sort of give it a jolt. And so it made timing chains more likely to fail. There were also, though, issues with the ignition and with the oil pump. So it started developing a reputation as a bit of a finicky, complex car. While we're at my usual junction, let's give it a pull through the gears and see how it goes. Hugely fast car, but it has a really, really nice mid-range, and as soon as the revs go up a little bit to sort of 2,500, 3,000, it really smooths out the engine. It's quite unlike any other engine that I've been in before in the way it feels, the way it revs. It's not massively torquey low down, and once you're past about 5,500 going towards 6, it tails off the power. So I've been thinking about what it is that makes the steering feel so unusual. I was struggling to put it into words earlier, and it is this. The self-centering is really quite strong, so it makes you feel like the car doesn't want to turn because you get some resistance the moment you try and push it off the dead straight. The thing is though, once you do move it off that little initial bit of resistance, the car just sort of darts in towards the corner and really follows the apex. So it's something that at the beginning is a little bit unnatural, but the more time you spend with the car and the more it works, particularly with what is supposed to be a GT like this, you can drive it on your fingertips. You don't feel any of the bumps. The whole car just floats down the road. The brakes, which have also been criticized because you've got that little button at the bottom and they say that they're too sharp. I think at speed, the brakes actually work really, really well. I think it's at parking speeds where you have to get used to being a bit more gentle with that little button. It doesn't have an awful lot of travel, but I think you'd get used to it really, really quick. What is really uncanny about the brakes, though, and it does actually, to me, feel really good, is that it doesn't do what most cars do. If you brake on most cars, the front end goes down. If you brake on this car, the back of the car goes down. Paul, the owner, was telling me about that. He said it was a bit like a duck landing on water, and he's absolutely right. It's almost as if the back end comes in to land, and it might sound to you like it's unnatural, but it actually fills you with confidence. It's not natural to pitch forward like that, whereas for the whole car to kind of hunker down gives you more confidence in it. I can imagine how relaxed it would be to cover ground on this. Apparently the design brief at the time, when they were making this, was that it had to be able to go from Paris to Monte Carlo to Monaco on one tank of fuel with four adults at an average speed of 100 miles an hour. And I think it could do that in its sleep. If you consider this was being sold in the early 70s, I think you have to admit, you have to agree with me that it is an absolutely astounding car and fantastic in so many ways, a brilliant GT. There is one area dynamically where it does fail, and that is the refinement and idle. And that's more important than you would think, and because someone who's looking to buy a luxury car, the first impression they get when they switch the car on is that it just doesn't feel like a premium engine. When you get going, it performs its brief brilliantly. 3 to 5,000 revs is roughly where you want to keep it. Works really, really well. But that is one of the failings. Overall, though, this is a car that definitely deserved to succeed. I mentioned the reliability issues, and I think they played a part. The oil crisis played a part, but there is something else. When they were developing this car, Citroën got into debt by £110 million. That was back in between 1968 and 1970. In 2 years, they accumulated that amount of debt. When sales of the SM dropped so radically with the oil crisis, they were unable to keep going. So ultimately, this car, there's also another project, the Bayrota. I think maybe this was even more responsible for it, but ultimately Citroën went bankrupt in 74 and they were taken over by Peugeot in 75, and that is an absolute crying shame, because cars like these are, to me, just legendary. Thank you all so much for watching. It's massively appreciated. If you enjoyed the video, please do subscribe. If you have an interesting quirky car that you want me to review, Instagram is the best way. Please do subscribe if you haven't already, because it really helps the channel. And I look forward to seeing you for the next video.